I've often heard people talk about the work of Byron Katie as the how. There's the what of spiritual development, you know, freedom, what it looks like. It's described so well in terms of essence in the Enneagram. There's so many ways to talk about it in many traditions. And there are many ways in terms of the how, but Byron Katie's is such a simple and easily accessible how. Like, take this step, follow this step, go through these little points, and there's often some evolution happening in just 20, 30 minutes.
Welcome to another episode of What It's Like to Be You. My name is Josh Levine, your host. Today is a continuation of my practitioner talks series where I interview facilitators of different modalities of inner work. And today my guest is Todd Smith, who is a facilitator of the work of Byron Katie. If you've never heard of Byron Katie, she is essentially an enlightened person. She woke up around when she was 42, and she is, I think, in her late 80s now. And she came up with a way of inquiring into your stressful thoughts and beliefs that she calls the work. It is truly one of the most powerful and incisive modalities of inner work that I've ever experienced. For that reason, I also have personally resisted it more than any other modality of inner work, which actually in this conversation we get into a little bit. Todd is a remarkably gifted facilitator of the work, and I structure this conversation in the following way. We talk a little bit about what the work is, then he actually facilitates me through the work, and then we debrief and talk about how the Enneagram and the work intersect. This is the longest episode that I've ever released, and I kept it this length because I wanted you to get a sense of the rhythm and pacing of what it is to do the work. I cut out some of the silences, but obviously feel free to move around if you're just over it, but I wanted you to get a sense of what a full session of doing the work really is. Finally, I want to just highlight how impressive it is that Todd is certified through Byron Katie's organization. It takes a tremendous amount of time and dedication to do that, and he's been facilitating the work for 15 years on his own. He has his own clients. He also has his own podcast that you can check out called Wiggle Room, where he facilitates the work just like he did with me here. So without further ado, I'm very excited for you to meet and experience the work via my friend Todd. So to make things really concrete for a second, just for listeners who don't know what the work is, the first thing that happens is you identify a stressful thought. And like, I experience that as, well, that happens to me all the time, every day, a million times. Some situations, somebody or something is frustrating and there's like an inner wincing. And there's the kind of, as you approach doing the work, you recall that moment to mind. And then here's the fascinating thing, you actually fill out a worksheet. Like, the work is based on filling out a piece of paper. And it's specifically called a Judge Your Neighbor worksheet, right?
I love that name.
Which is, yeah. And there are just six, as I recall, six prompts on the worksheet. And the prompts are helping you to get it is encouraging you to be as judgmental and petty as possible, to just get it all out on paper.
Yes.
I'm frustrated with my mom because she's not listening to me. What do I need her to do? I need her to shut up, and I need her to grow up. I need her to be, whatever. You just say everything that is actually coming to mind.
Yeah.
And give yourself permission to do that. A lot of people struggle with that, as I've seen, just giving yourself permission to be as petty as you quote, as what's really in you. Mm-hmm. And then once it's on paper, then this process begins where you take each statement and you take it through these, as you're saying, the four questions, and then something called the turnarounds, and that's the process of the work. Did I miss anything? Just concretely, like how it works. Just,
yeah, no, I'm glad you backed up, yeah, and explained that, because that is exactly it. You're starting with some specific situation, and letting yourself rant onto paper, just like,
yeah,
hate her and she's stupid and she should do that and I need the, it's like, yeah, letting the tantrum happen. And then
tantrum is such a good word for it. Yeah, having the, yeah, tantrum. Yeah, yeah.
And then you're capturing that. First of all, it's therapeutic to do that, but then you're also capturing that onto paper, writing down your exact words, not missing a word. And then you take those exact words, which are connected to your emotion and to your whole experience of that situation, and you're questioning those words. And when you do, your experience changes. So it's like doing, you know, surgery on something, but it's the handle is the thoughts that I had in that moment. So that's a kind of an overview of what the work is. It's a kind of meditation. When I say meditation, I mean it's experience-based rather than understanding-based. Understanding is important, and there's an element of understanding that comes in the work. But when I say experience-based, I mean it starts with a moment that I got triggered, which is an experience. It's an emotional, visceral thing. And then I go through and I'm experiencing, how did I react under that thought, and who would I be in that without that thought? And I'm experiencing, what would it be like? Are there turnarounds that make sense? It's an experience. And so when you go through that experience, things shift inside and you see the same situation oftentimes differently, and it's not stressful. And so now suddenly I have a new version of that history, a new version of that situation that is not triggering. And when I go back out into the world and encounter something similar, there's a high chance of that not actually triggering me again. And it might, or it might be less, or I'll be a little more aware of it. I may still need to do some more work, but it's just becoming less of a big deal because I'm seeing more, a bigger perspective. Yeah.
So what I thought we'd do is come up with a situation on my side that was frustrating, or that I experienced as stressful, and then filling out some or all of a worksheet, and then doing the work a little bit just to demonstrate what it is.
Yes. It's hard to understand abstractly. It definitely is. So yeah. Let's see if we can find a concrete situation that would be an example for this.
Okay, cool. One of them is a very particular memory of last week going to dinner with a friend. And this is a friend that I've done the work on a number of times. I'm not going to share his name. We've known each other for a very long time, and I get triggered by him very easily. And it's just a normal situation. We're at dinner and he's asking me questions about just what's your update. And I'm sharing of myself, and his reflections don't quite feel attuned. They're too positive reframing. I don't feel like he's meeting me in my inner experience. And on some level, I'm feeling infantilized by his response.
So the situation, you were at dinner, and remember, was it just the two of you? Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you're sitting across from each other, I assume, at a table, something like that?
Right. Sitting across from each other.
Okay. So yep. I ask these kind of questions simply to bring in the details of the situation. You may, throughout this piece of work, want to just place yourself there, like you're at the table, you're with your friend, you see what he's wearing, you see he or she what they're wearing, you know where you are, you know what's around in the room. Like, that is a very grounding kind of experience. And from there, a lot of answers are going to come because you're actually there. So that's how I like to do the work, in a particular moment, in a particular space. So when you're with this friend and you were talking about something, I don't know, and then they were reflecting back to you, like maybe too positive kind of reframing, or you said even infantilizing a little bit. What describes best what, let's get even more specific, even before I ask you that, do you remember, or are you willing to share what you might have been saying, or what they were replying to? Anything specific that you'd like to mention?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so I'm taking myself back there. I think I was saying something about the ways that I was trying to basically bootstrap my way out of a depression. It's like, I'm feeling this way, my mood is all over the place, and I'm trying to restructure my days just so I can get out earlier for a walk, get some sunlight, and just do the things that, just like the very basic things that I know will be helpful for my mood. Yeah. And so it's a very kind of like humble, like chop wood, carry water, just like get myself to a better mood, mm-hmm. kind of an idea in the context of all this psychological weight and emotional residue that I had been carrying from the last however many months, and just like the state of life, I guess it's also useful to say I've been, you know, feeling like just generally not happy and needing to make some life changes. Like maybe I move out of New York, or maybe I switch up my coaching practice, or maybe I pour more life energy into this Enneagram school and try to build it. I'm trying to find some way to meaningfully improve my life so I can be happier. But starts with this kind of mood enhancing, just walks in the morning kind of thing. So that's, I was saying something like that. It was just that general state of affairs.
Okay, that's great. So we have a clear idea, or you have a clear idea of what you're saying more or less, and what you were trying to share. And then what was your friend saying, or what were they doing to you in your interpretation there?
I remember at one point I remember recounting the situations that had happened that had been hard and stressful and painful, and just to kind of provide some context for how I was feeling. And at one or maybe even more than one of those moments, he did this thing where he kind of reached his hand across and just goes, "Oh God, I'm so sorry." I just put his hand just like in a way that I experienced as like performative and infantilizing, and just like, it was almost like doing a thing that he knew he was like doing, an empathy, doing empathy, but not just like being with me in my experience, you know?
Okay, perfect. So this is
that's
like,
a good one.
Now we're really entering into the concrete here. Like you're recounting the last 5 months of different things, that hardships that you've been through and tough, stressful situations. And on one or more of those, he's reaching across and saying, "Oh, I'm so sorry." Like that kind of, just very, I can't even imitate it very well, but
right.
You got the idea. So that's your stressful moment. Now we have the stressful situation is at dinner talking with a friend with some general kind of stress about them infantilizing. But the stressful moment is you talking about last 5 months and him reaching across the table and saying, "I'm so sorry." So now I'm really landed.
I'm laughing because it's like that was just the first stressful moment. There's like others, positive reframing, you know, pulling out a more redemptive arc than I was internally experiencing, you know, just like, I'm so proud of you for, you know, all that kind of stuff. But anyway, but are you suggesting just focus on the one moment?
I am suggesting that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying we can't or you can't move to some of those other places, and there is a freedom to move around a bit. But my experience is, The more specific you are, the more you're able to know exactly what you were talking about in that moment. It's like it just lands. I call it picking a portal. That's your portal. So like you can't go through two portals at the same time. So just pick one and see how far you go through that one.
Okay, that's good.
Of course, what I'm saying here is there's an infinite number of ways to do the work on something, and you don't really have to do them all. That's the cool thing. It's just do one, see where it goes. It might be enough. But I find that the details, the specifics, actually hold more than the generalities. The mind tends to hide in generalities. Whereas when it's in the specific, we're dealing with something really hard to move around. We'll see how it goes. But don't feel like you're locked in as well. Like, yes, I like to hold that. But your mind may bounce out into other moments, and even in that same conversation, and that's okay as well.
Okay.
So in that moment, when he reaches across and says, "I'm so sorry," what is he doing to you? And what's your emotional interpretation of what he's doing there in that moment? To you. Why is it personal?
Yeah. I feel like he's feeling sorry for me is close. I feel like he's thinking I'm pathetic or something, or treating me as though I'm pathetic, you know, that kind of, that vibe, that flavor. Mm-hmm. That's a good place to start.
It's a really good place to start. So yeah. We have a situation, a moment, and now what I like to call the emotional interpretation. Like what he did there, in the moment, what did he do to you? Literally, he reached across and said, "I'm so sorry." That was what he did. That's the statement of fact. But what your mind is interpreting there is that he's thinking that you're pathetic. That's what gives this juice. And that's what we're looking for when we're identifying the stressful thought connected to this stressful experience. So does that feel right? Like that is close to what's really bothering you there?
It's close. I would amend it maybe to he's not like fully respecting me or something like that. It feels closer, but
we can brainstorm on this if you want, just to see what words seem closest. This is part of the meditation. It's like looking for, okay, I found the situation. The stress is real, but what is the thought that I'm thinking here that's making it so stressful for me? Maybe he's thinking I'm pathetic. Maybe he's not fully respecting me, feeling sorry for me. If you want, brainstorm some more until you feel comfortable.
Yeah, let's see. It's like some assertion of a reality where he's like, he's giving me something he thinks I need or would want in that moment, which is just totally not right. It's like, so that's I guess the feeling.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. So
makes me feel annoyed. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So let's write a line one of the worksheet, something like, I'm annoyed with him because what would you say? Because he.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to pull up, I have on my screen here, I'm going to pull up. Okay.
This is the judge your neighbor worksheet, line one.
That's right. So the judge your neighbor worksheet, the first question, I'll just read it out loud so people know, is that in this situation, who angers, confuses, saddens, or disappoints you, and why? I am. So this is me filling it out. I am annoyed with my friend because he's misreading and not respecting me in the way that I want to be respected. Not attuning to me. Misreading me, not attuning to me.
Okay. Okay. Good. So does that hold it, that he's not attuning to me? Like the misreading and not attuning is almost like two separate pieces there. We can go with it, but it's often a little harder to work if there's two ideas that are separate contained in one sentence. Is it possible to go with one or the other, misreading or not attuning to me? Or does one contain the other?
I have to narrate what's happening in my head right now, just because it might be interesting for you to comment on. What's happening is I'm sitting here just playing this moment back in my head of him reaching across the table and feeling infantilized or patronized. He's patronizing me. That's the word. There it is. That's it. That's it. That's it. That's it.
Cool.
Yeah, what was happening in my head was, it was like, I was thinking to myself, he thinks I'm this fragile thing, but he needs to like do this thing. And then I started almost like getting ahead of myself, doing a turnaround. Like I started thinking, well, if this is how I'm reacting to him reaching a hand across the table, then maybe I am this fragile thing, you know, like.
Right. Right. And so that's kinda something you have to watch out for when you're writing a judge your neighbor worksheet, or when you're identifying the stressful thoughts to question. That's not the time to do turnarounds. That's the time to just let the stuck part rage or complain or, have that tantrum we were talking about. And this is the time to just let It have free reign. Okay, yeah. What is he doing? Oh, he's not attuning to me. He's misreading me. He's, oh yeah, he's patronizing me. Oh, yeah, that's it. Like, that's what you're trying to do. Is you finally listen to this thing in here that's obviously felt something, and you're asking it, what is that? What did you feel? And it's very actually empowering to allow yourself to answer that and take time to find it, because now you're more connected with what was actually happening to you in that moment. You have the words that match with the feeling.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. So now we have your line one. I'm annoyed. I assume the emotion is the same. I'm annoyed with him because he's patronizing me. Okay.
That's good. Cool. Yeah.
So do you want to go and fill in more of the Judge Your Neighbor worksheet just to show how that works? Or do you want to go right into questioning the stressful thought?
This is a bit of a, just for the demonstration, let's do like a rapid fire, fill out the rest of the worksheet, and then we'll come back to any one of these. So,
okay. So line two, and if you have it right in front of me, you can read it as well. But it should be something like, what advice can you give to that other person? I'm sorry. What do you want in that situation? How do you want them to change?
That's it. Yeah. Yeah. I have, the line is, in this situation, how do you want him or her to change? What do you want him or her to do? I want him to slow down, chill out, tune to me energetically. Stop patronizing me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Stop seeing me as this pathetic thing that needs to be reached for in this way. That needs to be comfort in this dramatic. That's what I want.
Perfect. Okay.
Yeah.
So line two, you really get to hear the tantrum come out. It's like, I want him to slow down, chill out, tune in.
Yeah.
Stop patronizing me. Stop seeing it as pathetic. Like, that's it. Okay. So now you have to kind of get that off your chest first. Then the next layer, the next line on the worksheet is advice. Once I've ranted a bit, then I still have some complaints, but they're more subtle. And those complaints are coming out in the form of advice. So what should he do? What shouldn't he do? What would help him to do it the way I want him to do it? So I'm still manipulating, but what's your advice to him in that situation? He should, he shouldn't.
He should chill out. he should chill out. He should learn how to just be more natural with his empathy, not so dramatic and performative. He should know what I need as his friend of 20 years. He should just kind of know at this point. He should know what I need when I need it. That's my advice.
Yep, exactly. Okay.
Yeah.
So then, having said that, then what he, let's assume here, I mean, that was your experience, was that he was actually being patronizing to you. So if that's the case, you can't take that back. It's done. What would he need to do now when he's patronizing, it's almost like there's a kind of wounding that's happening, and that would be the way the mind would interpret it. He's patronizing me, and therefore there's some kind of wound here emotionally that's happening. What would he need to do? What would I need him to do to undo that wound? Is there anything he could do, having patronized me, to make it right or to make me feel good again afterwards? What would you need? I need him to.
And just to, I'll read the sentence on the worksheet. It says, in order for you to be happy in this situation, what do you need him or her to think, say, feel, or do?
Yeah.
So and this is not to like make up for the mistake, that I feel he made, right? This is just, if we could rewrite the whole situation, right? It's like...
No, it's actually to address what he did, to fully... To fully forgive him, what would you need him to do? Like, in order for you to be...
Oh, yeah, okay.
Like, this is no longer an issue for me. I would need some things. So what would those be?
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it may be on the level of what do you need him to notice or be aware of, or that sometimes is a starting point with this.
Yeah, I would not. I would want for him to notice. It's kind of like the mismatch was he noticed me expressing some kind of pain and then like really tuned into that. But what I would have certainly preferred for him to do is just kind of mirror back the current edge of my inner experience. What I mean by that is like, not all the context that I'm setting, not the pain that I was in, but just like what I'm doing now and how I'm feeling now and the path that I've set myself on, and just kind of like affirm that, and not in a patronizing way, but just like in a way that makes me feel like he really gets me, believes in me, is kind of with me. Yeah, I think ultimately what I'm really wanting is a clear and sincere, like a really genuine sense that he like loves and believes in me, to figure this out on my own, and that he's like there to support, but not to advise or patronize or whatever. Just like a sense of unconditional belief that at the same time acknowledges like the totality of my inner experience.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So in the need, some of this actually fits very well under advice. Like we were talking in number three, like I need.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
To, you know, I need him to, basically mirror back my current edge, you know, edge of my inner experience. I need him to see, or he should see, he should affirm me. I need him to give a clear and sincere sense that he loves and believes in me.
That's good.
So they can fit sometimes. That's almost more in the advice place. But what I'm seeing in number four is that he should notice that he didn't do those things, right? And then what would you need from him if he'd finally noticed that, to really say, okay, we're back on the same page again? Is there anything
more
he could say?
Mm-hmm. He could acknowledge that he's terrible at this. he could apologize. He could affirm and recognize that I'm better at this. I'm the expert in this, you know. Mm-hmm. So again, I'm just letting
you know. This is it. We're giving free reign to this to speak. Yeah, recognize.
I want him to sort like to. I want like an expression of humility from him. You know that like, this is sort of my territory or something, terrain. You know, like I'm the inner world expert or something like that. That would be a way to do it. What else? And just a sense of like partly the wound that I'm excavating in real time here is like a sense of, there's just this way that I feel like even on the subjects that I've like really put a lot of effort into developing myself, somehow he holds himself as an expert or more expert or equal, which mm-hmm. feels like, yeah, bad. Like I want, I would want a, like an acknowledgement, a sincere, non unperformative, genuine acknowledgement of like what he actually respects about me.
Yeah. I love it.
Great. And then, yeah. And then maybe like a willingness to follow that up with, to just like be a friend and support, but not in a patronizing or advice giving or I know the way and here's my advice to you kind of way, just like a co-explorer, co-traveler, respecting kind of way.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's, there we go. That's that.
You nailed it. Okay. Okay. So this is what you need in order to be happy. You can feel it when you land on it. And this is what I mean by having, giving, I say giving the mic to this part in here that got hurt and letting it say, and it might take some time to find out what it even feels, but find out what it really needs here. What is it? What is the real advice? What is it that you really want them to do differently? And what is it you need them to do to make this all feel fine again? So just doing this is amazing work right here. We are doing the work, even though we haven't even gotten to the four questions and the turnarounds. And I love it. Okay.
Yeah.
So the next line, line five, is what do you think of him in that situation? Be petty, be small, allow that part to rant a little more. What do you think of him when he is patronizing to you like that? He is what? Make a list.
He's arrogant, dense, incorrigible. Not really the kind of person that I want as my friend. Out of touch with out of touch. Out of touch is good. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good. This feels complete.
That's a good list there. So the last one is, what is it that you don't ever want to experience with him again? This kind of situation. Don't ever want him to...
Yeah. I don't ever want to feel small in comparison. I don't ever want to feel I don't ever want to feel like I have to keep like fighting for the kind of attunement that I need or want. You know, I want to just know how to give it. Like I'm tired of this whole dance, you know, of like we meet, I get frustrated, correct. And then like after 45 minutes, then we finally land together. That fighting thing. I guess I don't ever want to feel pathetic. That would be a good one. I don't ever want to feel pathetic.
Mm-hmm. Well,
or like I'm desperate for empathy or desperate for. You know, like weak and desperate for comfort.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is great. And as you were speaking, I was writing down as best I could all of the sentences that you spoke, and I'll send them to you.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you.
But this is filling in a Judge Your Neighbor worksheet. We found a moment, found a stressful situation. You know exactly what you're talking about. And look how much is contained in this one little moment of him reaching across with his hand. Could have been another moment, but just picking this one moment, so much, the whole relationship, or there's so much about me, you know, so much about you in this particular moment. And what we've done is we've allowed that stress to speak and tell us what was going on. The value of starting with stress, and the work is a funny meditation this way because it starts with stress.
Right.
Oh, let's go be peaceful. I'm going to meditate. Okay, great. Well, what? Pick a stressful situation. Like what? So it's a strange thing, but the value of it is stress doesn't lie. Stress is honest. So you've now started with a very honest benchmark. It's an honest starting point, which is all the thoughts and complaints and wishes and everything you thought you wished was different, all those thoughts connected to that feeling that you were having in that moment, which is connected to the real your real life and shows up in other moments as well. So just working this one moment can have repercussions across many different situations. But we're dealing with something real. That's what I love. It's true, it's real. It's meaningful because it's connected to my emotion. And now we're not just doing an intellectual puzzle when we do the work. We're working with your innards. You've brought them to the surface. And that makes a huge difference. Okay, so shall we do a little bit of the four questions part of the work?
Let's do it, yeah.
Okay, so let's start with the first one, which is what I found, which is he is patronizing. The whole sentence was, I'm annoyed with him because he's patronizing me. The part we're going to question is the actual piece, he's patronizing me. The annoyed is how I react. We'll get to that. But
right.
The main thing is he's patronizing me. So as you begin to answer these questions and throughout the process, excuse me, be at that dinner, be there across the table from him and hold as much as is comfortable or appropriate that motion that he did when he reached over and said he was so sorry about it, so sorry for you. So that's the reference point. And so just close your eyes for a minute and remember that. Be there. Be there, actually there. You can maybe even smell the smells of the restaurant. If that was, I think you said it was a restaurant. And the ambiance, and then, but then the whole situation you've just been talking about past 5 months and all that. And here he goes, I'm so sorry. So in that moment, he's patronizing you. Is it true?
I feel emotional. Uh, I found the answer no inside, but I also want, because just out of instruction, the second question is so good. So, so my real answer is no.
Okay.
Yeah.
And again, when we're answering these questions, what I'm looking for is that part of you that originally wrote this worksheet, that one that we've just been enjoying hearing from, mm-hmm. that's the same one that I'm wanting to hear the answer from. Is he patronizing you, the yes or the no? And so there are different levels of truth. And
I think that's a huge point you just made.
Yeah.
You got to sit with that one for a second.
Yeah. Okay.
So because you're not wanting an answer from the wise one that already knows the answer is no.
That's
you're
correct. Looking at it. That part doesn't need to do the work. It's just that's the part could say, oh, nothing's true. Yeah. Like really wise. But I'm asking the part that was feeling patronized in that moment, is it really true? Are you sure? Is it true that your friend was patronizing you? And I just want honesty, that's all.
Okay, now my answer is I don't know.
Mm-hmm. That happens, and that's okay. What Byron Katie created in this question is kind of a I don't know what you'd say, like
a forced choice
yes
answer
or a no. She's forcing us to land on a yes or a no, and
it's an
exercise. There will be truth on both sides, quite possibly. So the mind can get hung up on I don't know, but don't worry about having the perfect answer or the absolutely true answer for sure. Just be as honest as you can with your experience in that moment and what you see as you're looking at it now.
No.
Okay. So since your answer to question one was no, then we'll skip question two, which is, can you absolutely know it's true? Which is just a reiteration of that question, another chance to go in and look even closer to be sure. But in either case, questions one or two, yes and no, are equally good answers. There's no right answer. Like some people think no is the right answer, but both are equally good. All we want to do is give that little stuck part a chance to evaluate for itself and find out how it sees it, honestly, and gives it another chance to do so. So since your answer was no, it's not true that he was patronizing you, then the question three is, how do you react? What happens? Again, be in the moment, sitting there across from your friend, and your friend says, I'm so sorry. How do you react when you think he's patronizing you in that moment?
It's like my whole inner being winces and all of a sudden I find myself defensive against that, like don't fucking patronize, you know, that kind of I don't really have any more inner space. I'm just kind of reacting and filled with a certain kind of toxicity.
Yeah. So this is how you react when you think he's patronizing you. How do you treat him in that moment? Even if it may be overtly or it may be just in your mind, how do you treat him at that point and from then forward when you think he was patronizing you there?
I have to say one thing about this part of the process. This is sometimes why I resist doing the work, is because I I can get into this. It's kind of like once you know what the work is and you've done it once, and like if you've seen Byron Katie facilitate, whatever, there's this expectation that sort of gets super glued to the work, which isn't actually quote unquote supposed to be there, but it's like this feeling like, oh, I'm doing the work, you know, I better give an answer that actually communicates that I'm changing, you know, from this process, or that I'm seeing things differently. And so it's like, if there is frustration left in me, or if, even as I was talking about that, like frustration was kind of growing in me, but then I found myself saying, or kind of questioning my own story anyway. So it can kind of like the meditative aspect of like actually seeing what's true for yourself, for myself, I can kind of get into a super ego answering kind of thing where I'm just giving the quote unquote right answer, but it's not sincere.
Yes.
And I feel like I'm supposed to be healing, you know, that doesn't, that doesn't work. And then I finish the session resenting the work.
That's right. Yeah. And it's,
yeah.
So that's a really good point that you brought up. And that's why, like I was mentioning, it's this stuck part that's answering the question. I want immature answers here. I want incomplete answers. I don't want right answers. I want what's true for you. And like when I ask, how do you treat him? Maybe there you don't treat him. Maybe that's not a, that doesn't even resonate with you. Then you would just say, I don't treat him any differently, or, you know, whatever it is. Like there's no compulsory answers, or there's nowhere that you have to go with the work. They're just questions. They're open questions. And the mind may put on, oh, I need to answer it this way to get free or something, but it's just the opposite. I need to answer my way, even if it means there's no answer, in order to be me. It's self-inquiry. So yeah, if you're trying to fit into a template or trying to match how you've seen other people do the work, people in the work can fall into cliches in answering these questions, and they
right.
just can be, oh yeah, it's the, you know, and then you can just kind of go on autopilot without actually touching what's going on inside, without actually really doing the work. And what I love about what you said here is that you're attuned to that, and that you're for you, you don't want to do lip service to some process like this. You want it to either be real or not do it. And I'm with you. That's exactly the way I like to see it. Like, let's not cheapen this by trying to come up with right answers, because they never serve. They never touch me. So whenever I ask a question, consider it to be optional and consider it to be just a prompt, but you're the one that that is looking and seeing what you see or don't see within yourself as you're exploring this way. That's how to answer the questions.
I guess that, like, just to kind of put a button on like where I actually, the sincere thing to say about that is like, I feel pissed. You know, like,
yeah, okay,
yeah,
yeah.
I feel pissed. I'm like, you know, stop fucking doing that. You know, like, yes. Get the fuck out of here. That's how I feel, you know.
That's it. This is the uncensored version of how you react, and that's it. We're seeing what happens to you when this thought gets injected in there. He's patronizing me. You become really pissed and you act accordingly. Yeah, perfect. Okay, so any ways that comes out towards him directly, any kind of speech or indirect speech or passive aggressive action, or just things that you're thinking towards him that you're not saying? I don't know.
It's like a certain kind of aggression enters my eyes, but I'm stuck. I'm stuck in this place because I, on the one hand, I'm playing into this like frame that he's asserted that he's being really compassionate, you know, So on the one hand, I'm sort of like honoring him within that frame. Like, I really appreciate, you know, thank you for so much. On the other, so that's like a performance, like a play acting. On the other hand, I'm also just like internally, I don't know, seeing, I'm just seeing red, you know, I'm seeing a certain kind of red. So
absolutely.
I'm sorry. What was your question? What am I answering?
The actual
now?
Question was, how do you treat him? How does it come
how do
out?
I treat him. Yeah. I hold him at a much greater psychological distance.
Yep.
I judge him for being bad at attuning. Yeah. I feel sort of like disgusted by, by him and what just happened. And I feel amazed in a sort of like judgmental way. Like, whoa, yeah. Like how did, like, you've done so much work. Like how is this, how are you still doing that? You know, right. Kind of thing.
Right.
I also start thinking about the Enneagram. I start thinking about his Enneagram type. This is good.
Yeah.
And I start putting him in that box. I start seeing, oh God, you're just doing that 7 thing of whatever. Like, you're just cerebrally affirming, you know, you're doing the thing. It's like all in the mind, and like your heart and body aren't actually connected to what you just said. I start seeing him as an object of a framework as opposed to a person.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
these two are
reactions.
Yeah.
That question, how do you treat him, is a kind of sub question of the thought of the first question I said, or I said third question, how do you react? What happens? How do you react? How do you treat him? How do you treat yourself? Could be another question. Like, what images do you see from the past or future? Those are other questions. Where do you feel it in your body? What emotions? These are all under the umbrella of how do you react, which we're calling one question, question 3, how do you react?
Right, right.
Yeah. Okay. And we could spend more time in there. You can really enjoy is maybe not the right word, but you can sometimes it's very helpful to just see all of the reactions that come out from believing a particular thought. In this case, he's patronizing.
Yeah.
So the next question, just to keep moving a little bit, is who would you be in that same situation when he reaches his hand over and says, I'm so sorry. Who would you be if you didn't have the thought that he was patronizing you in that moment?
Well, I wouldn't be wincing. You know, I can't tell. I don't know for sure, but I would either be open to actually receiving whatever attunement and connectedness is available through that gesture,
mm-hmm.
like putting it in the play, or like letting the parts of me that actually could be nourished by it be nourished by it. Or I'd be more just clear and direct about that gesture not quite working for me or something.
Mm-hmm.
I guess ultimately, like at an emotional level, I would feel more relaxed. Like I wouldn't be worked up about this whole miss.
Yeah. So what we're seeing here is again the effect of the thought. With the thought, there's all the stress reaction that you just described, and maybe more that we didn't even cover. And without the thought, there's more relaxation and almost an ability possibly to even receive some of the caring that he's sending your way, even though it wasn't perfectly executed. Mm-hmm. So it's the thought. You know, when you do an experiment in science, you keep everything the same, except you change one variable. So that's what we just did. We did a little thought experiment with the thought in the same situation and without the thought in the same situation. And then what's the difference? Is there a difference? And what we're seeing is, there is a difference. With the thought he's patronizing me, I'm reactive. Without the thought he's patronizing me, I'm relaxed. Yeah. So that's the effect of that thought, regardless of whether it's true or not. And we already saw that it wasn't true. Uh, wasn't according to what you found. So now we have kind of two points against this thought, that it's not really 100% true necessarily, and it causes me to be, it doesn't really work for me, it causes me to be really stressed, and without it, I would be relaxed. So the point of these four questions is to kind of, I don't know what the word is, maybe it loosens a little bit my attachment to this story that he's
entered. Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
And then that prepares me for the next part of the work, which is the turnarounds, which are finding opposites and then seeing how those opposites could actually be true, finding examples to substantiate those opposites. If you don't do the four questions first and you just flip to turnarounds, it can feel kind of shocking because you're really just flipping something, and but you're still very attached to it, and it can be hard to find any room there. So
yeah.
So having done a little of the questioning, let's go into the turnarounds. He's patronizing me. What would be an opposite? There might be several opposites, but let's try one.
Right. So actually, well, just for people who don't know the work, the statement is, right, he's patronizing me, and then a turnaround is somehow, it's rearranging the statement.
It's like, I call it the technical turnaround. So it's like a grammatical.
That's right.
Change.
So he's patronizing me. There's, as I see it, there are three possible turnarounds, right? There's, I'm patronizing him. He's not patronizing me. And then I'm patronizing me.
Yeah. Those would be the three turnarounds on that.
Yeah.
In that statement.
All right. Yeah. So, okay. Let's do I'm patronizing him.
Okay. So now our job is we found the technical turnaround. I'm patronizing mm-hmm. him. Our job is, this is like a new hypothesis. So hold it as a new hypothesis. Let's see if we can find any evidence to support this idea that you may have been patronizing him as much or more, or maybe not, but let's look. Were you patronizing him in any way?
Yeah, I love this framing of a hypothesis. That's really good. Okay. Well, I've already revealed how petty I've been towards him and judgmental from the worksheet. So that's, you could call all that patronizing.
That counts, yeah. Even if you're just doing it in your mind, there's that same energy there.
Yep. So, yep. Yeah. Let's see. I think that the kind of the act of starting to put him in that, in the Enneagram box, and just seeing him through the lens of that framework is patronizing
mm-hmm.
in a certain sense, sort of dehumanizing. Yeah. I mean, the thought of like, sort of, how are you not good at this yet? How do you not see, you know, that itself is, I think that's the main one. That feels
great example. Yeah.
Patronizing. Yeah. So yes, I'm patronizing him.
Yeah. And what these examples do, what that example really, how it resonates with me is it starts to level the playing field. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. He may even have been patronizing. I don't know, but I was doing at least as much. I was doing it in a different way, but I was thinking, oh, he's not attuning to me. He's not doing it right. He's, you know, not as, after all the work he's done, and he's still like that. Like there's a
there's that
little element of patronization. Like I'm up and he's down. And when I see it in myself, it just balances out whatever he may or may not have been doing towards me. And now I'm seeing two human beings doing the best they can, but there's an equalizing, and I find that very liberating.
Yeah.
So, and you know, with all of these turnarounds, the principle that I hold when I'm doing turnarounds and finding examples, I call the principle of balance, that a turnaround is a balance to the original statement. And we're just looking for anything that might balance it out, like we just found here. And it may be that the original statement still has truth to it. Maybe they're both true. Or maybe I just was exaggerating this one, and I just have to cut it back down to size. Or maybe it just wasn't true at all, and the turnaround's the truer thing. So keeping that in mind, you can explore, and whatever you find, whatever that truth is, you're just looking for whatever balancing factors you may be able to find there. And some turnarounds just don't really work too. So I don't have to make them work. We'll just move on to another turnaround. Maybe there's something there.
I just want to say, I really appreciate you holding this turnaround, or just really your whole orientation throughout the process of actually asking yourself the question in a sincere way and not needing to come up with the right answer. That's really big, because as I've said, that's where I've gotten stuck, or like kind of started to resist the work, is that that's starting to feel like I have to prove the turnaround to myself, otherwise I've failed at the work or something like that.
Now I've got two stressful thoughts. I've got my original stressful thought, that's, and it. Now I've failed at the work.
There you go.
That's not helpful at all.
Right.
No. Right. I don't have an idea that I have to get anywhere when I do the work. Maybe I'll try the work and answer some questions, and you know, maybe it just doesn't, I don't really end up with any amazing insights, or I didn't really turn it around that well or whatever. But I go in with the idea that I'm going to explore, and I'm just going to put all my cards on the table, and I'm just going to see what shows up there. And it feels really freeing to do it that way. I can just look, and maybe there'll be something interesting. And over time, as I do the work, I do it every day, I just end up with an accumulation of wisdom and insights and ability to see through things that comes from knocking on lots of doors, and some answered and some didn't, and in the end it doesn't really matter. So I'm not trying to like nail it every time. I'm not trying to like make sure I get some particular outcome. Instead, I'm just exploring. That's my favorite way to describe the work, exploring.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
Okay, so is there another turnaround? He is patronizing me.
Yeah, let's do he's not patronizing me.
Okay. So how could that be possible? We don't know, but let's look. Is there any possibility that he's not patronizing you when he says he's so sorry like that?
I mean, it's possible he's actually sincere. Yeah, it's actually possible. How's that?
Radicals even think about that. How is it possible?
He's not patronizing me. I don't know what else to say.
That can be enough.
I think that's enough. Yeah. I mean,
just knowing that it's possible, you don't even have to know the details, but just the possibility that that's the way the words come out for him. And based on all his experience on giving that kind of kindness, that's the way it comes out. But it could have been sincere.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And sometimes you can even play with, we don't have to do it now, but you can sometimes even play with knowing him as you do, what kinds of things might he be thinking? What kinds of, it's just guessing. It's all in his business.
My mind was actually already starting to go there. Yeah.
I was in his business believing that he was patronizing me. So let me go back into his business and see if the other side could also be true. And those two might neutralize each other in the process.
That's good. Yeah. Yeah.
So if your mind was going there, then take a second. Anything come up in terms of possibility there?
Yeah, let me sit with it. I know I know that what is definitely sincere for him is that he has been like really, really trying to figure out how to do this empathy thing well. Like it's, I think he would not disagree with me. Yeah, he'd probably say this too, that he didn't start in a place of like being a natural empathizer, and he's like really worked at it. And so, you know, my experience is that sometimes his technique is, I don't know, sloppy or elementary or whatever. Somehow it just is in some way that it just doesn't quite attune to me. It doesn't feel like attuned to me, but I do know that he is demonstrably working on himself. I have a lot of evidence for that. And his consistent and his commitment over time to it has been consistent and admirable. And so I don't know how else to call that but sincere.
That's really cool. That's really cool. It's like it's almost like you see a kid, they're in first grade, and you can't expect them to be doing graduate work in first grade, but they're doing really well at where they started or where they're at. And it's not condescending. It's just a noticing of reality. Like, okay, he's using these kind of words or these kinds of gestures because that's his first attempts at it or his second attempts at it. And he may evolve further, but he started way behind on that particular area. It's fits in with the Enneagram here. Like we all have our little things that we're strong with and things that we're less strong with. But seeing it that way can just, again, soften the experience. Okay.
I have to say, I mean, just think sitting here with this, it's like, this is the second time I've gotten emotional thinking about it. It's like, something comes up. It's like, yeah, it feels like a softening. Like it feels like, just a way of seeing him more gently or with more of my heart online. It feels, feels like, you know, like I love my friend, you know?
Yeah.
Drives me fucking nuts, but I love him.
That's what friends are for. But I love it. That's it. Without actually knowing what he was thinking or saying, at the time, you don't have to actually know to find that softness, to find a loosening, to be freer of what was going on. And that's the power of this work, is that we don't have to get the ultimate answer from the person. We don't have to drag it out of them. We don't have to go explore or analyze them. We can even just guess. That's all we did here. Just imagine, guess, like what's possible? Is it possible that he's not patronizing me? And just that possibility is enough to bring in some balance to our own mind, which is all that we're looking for here.
I have to say, you know, that moment, this is so subtle. This is so subtle, but it's like this moment, this feeling, this emotion that comes up, it's like I could feel myself. Wow, I'm like almost embarrassed to start talking about this. I'm going to do it anyway. It's like I can feel myself. It's like, oh, this would be a good moment to show that I've come to the realization that I love my friend. You know, that's that performance piece that comes. And so like, and you know, on one level that's true, but I can also feel that it's sort of like, so in the Enneagram, you have like your primary type and your wing. I have a two wing, and there's like a certain like an inner superego insistence on being a loving person, on demonstrating love. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that kind of came in at that moment. Of course I love my friend, but it's more like, like what happened in that moment, the more sincere statement emotionally for me was just, I was feeling a tenderness, you know, I was just feeling a tenderness towards him.
That's it.
And towards myself, actually.
Yes.
Yeah. And I don't actually know that it was fully love, you know, yeah. it was a tenderness. That was the opening. So yeah, I guess I do want to amend, just to be truthful. I want to amend my statement. Yeah. Wow. That
I
was
love your
hard.
Dedication to truth. I love your dedication to truth. That's the spirit of doing the work. We're trying to find our truth here. We're not trying to put on a show. We're not trying to, you know, be kinder than we are or have the right answers. Even working one-on-one, pleasing a facilitator, or even pleasing ourselves, our superego, you might say, and just saying that oh, I finally have arrived, you know, I have done the work and now I'm over this. Like, that's neither here nor there. That's just another story. But what's important is just honest, what do I find? And if it's even just an iota of tenderness there, how cool is that? How cool is that? And if no tenderness shows up, what's wrong with that? Nothing. All I'm doing is exploring. And if you look at the explorers that have explored various aspects of our world, there are plenty that came home with nothing. And so not every exploration comes out with like a pot of gold.
That's good. That's very good. That's good for my type too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. God, isn't that funny how it's like, there's a way that somehow in my type structure, there's a way that I'm wanting to paint a version of the emotion that's arising, even if it is just like a tenderness, to sort of like frame it and make it glossier and kind of like present it as the final moment of arrival or something like that, as opposed to just where it actually is.
I might even say, I don't know enough to be able to say this with any certainty, but I would be willing to guess that that happens to all types, that we all exaggerate our good, you know, like our wins, and we want to post them and glorify them and make them seem bigger than they actually are. It's just, again, personality versus essence, right? It's like going for the fake version, which is great for show and looks good on the wall, versus the real version, which might be tiny and just the first sprouting of something. And so we give up that for something that sounds better, we can talk about to others. I think it's just the nature of the ego, really, the nature of the mind. I sometimes think of the ego as who I'm pretending to be. And sometimes I use that
as
a good
definition. That's, yeah, that's good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that has a whole, again, I'm going to refrain commentary too much Enneagram stuff, but there's a whole thing. I mean, that in the Enneagram, we would say that belongs in the heart center, the sort of image versus identity.
Cool. Yeah. Cool. So, you know, we could keep going. There's another turnaround.
Yeah.
We'll just kind of get the idea. It's like I'm patronizing myself, and you can just keep playing. Some of these turnarounds will make sense, some won't. But this is the flavor of it. You can go as slow as we've kind of done. You can go faster. You can take your, you know, you can take your time. But it's a process. And it's a meditation that you can dive into anytime you like and in any situation. You can do it in writing, you can do it with a friend, you can do it with a facilitator. There's just a lot of flexibility to it. But my favorite thing about it is it's just so real. It keeps it real. It starts with something real, my stressful situation and emotion. And then throughout the process, my idea is to find what's even truer for me than maybe even my original. Or maybe that's truer. Like, I'm going to default to truth and true. My truth, not the truth, but my experience. And when I do that, that allows me to remain in touch with myself and even deepen my connection with myself.
Yeah. Just because it's like salient, I'll say the turnaround of I'm patronizing myself is, I think, certainly true. I can certainly feel a truth in that too. Like the accepting the frame in a certain way, you know, like I am this weak thing that needs to, that I noticed a certain way that I was seeing myself as small, and needing to kind of defend myself. You know what I'm saying? So that's,
yeah, it's a great turnaround. Yeah. Like, yeah, yeah. Who's doing what to who, right? I don't even if he's patronizing me or not, but look at me, I'm putting me down. I'm thinking,
that's right.
What did you say? Something like, I'm compared to other people. I don't have the
small compared. Yeah.
Like, so that's self-patronization, you could say.
That's right. Yeah.
And if that wasn't going on, it might not have even been that stressful, even if he did actually patronize you.
Right. So, right.
Yeah. It's like someone lays a weapon down in front of you and then you pick it up and hit yourself with it. It's like someone. So
that's really good. Yeah.
That's what we all do.
Yeah. Well, okay. So just to kind of neatly tie things, that completes the work, right? So you identify a stressful situation, you fill out a judge your neighbor worksheet, you pick a statement, you do the turnarounds, and usually there's two or three turnarounds. And different statements on the worksheet also have different kinds of turnarounds, right? Like statements 5 and 6 have different, but
yes,
it's all written out on the worksheet if you want to actually do the work. That's the process. And you kind of, and it's important to do that, do the process sort of in sequence. As you were saying, like not to just jump to the turnarounds, but to kind of investigate the original thought first.
Yeah, it's a sequence that works, and it's not absolute, but yes, it does help
to
just kind of go from beginning to end, and it's tried and true. Yeah.
That's good. So first of all, thank you. The work just amazes me. See, like my experience of myself having just completed that for a second is, that tenderness I was talking about is sort of here. It's like present. I don't know how many words I have to share what has happened for me, but maybe I don't need to frame it up. It's just kind of like, yeah, something inner. I guess I feel a little softer than when I started. That's a good way to put it.
That's a great description of it. It's very subtle. The effects of the work, I find are often not flashy, can be, but most of the time they're just very subtle. I just suddenly, or not suddenly, but through the process, I just see the situation differently. I see my friend differently. I see myself differently. And it's a difference of seeing. And so a difference in seeing doesn't seem like much, but when you go back into situations like that again, maybe with your friend or with other people, it'll be interesting to see how much, if there remains any difference. So it's like something shifts in my vision. Like I took a little, something was on the glass and I rubbed it clean and it's not there now. It doesn't feel like anything's that different. It feels kind of normal. But then I notice sometime that I'm in a similar situation and that thing that was getting in the way is no longer getting in the way. And it's just no big deal. So for me, no big deal is kind of what used to be a stressful situation. If I've experienced it again as no big deal, that's my test, whether the work worked or not. And if it does still react, I still do react, all that means is great. Another opportunity to take another pass, to identify another stressful thought, do a little more work, and it deepens. There's layers. And so, great, I peeled off one layer. I'm seeing a little more clearly. Over time, I may peel off other layers. I may get clearer and clearer. And that's how relationships change. That's how situations that used to be stressful can become non-stressful. But it's more like coming back to yourself. So it's just normal. I'm becoming more normal as opposed to getting some huge aha and the story of awakening and all of that. It's just, okay, that one doesn't get me anymore. Cool, I like it. That's all there is. And I often find it, there is a little gentle softness in doing the work. I sometimes think of it like I'm taking a little bath or something. I feel a little nicer after the work, but oh. No big deal. I'm not going to like write a blog article about it or something. You know, just, okay, yeah, it's good. What's next?
Yeah. I've said this before. I think that the work is in really the top, say, five. It might even be the top, like, practice that I've seen that you can bring yourself to that has, it's just like super high impact. I mean, it's like the, it's like when you do it and you do it sincerely. And what I mean by sincerely is like in the way that you kind of guided me through just really investigating, exploring, looking for what's true, not trying to force yourself into a correct answer. The work is one of the most effective practices of inner work that I've ever encountered. And it also, and I think we talked about this before, is the thing that it's one of the inner work practices that I see the most resistance to.
Right.
And it's really not hard to see why, in my view, because it's kind of like, well, my friend's pissing me off. You know, they need to do the work, for God's sake, you know, or like the world needs to change in some way. And when you pitch it, like, well, when you do the work, you investigate your thoughts, and all of a sudden you feel a little lighter, softer, you've changed your perspective. And so the situation changed. It's like, that's not a very, you can't really market that very well. And no. It's, yeah. And so I guess I'm fascinated by that paradox. It's like the work really does help. And yet it's the thing that I see a lot of resistance to. And I personally have resisted it probably more than any other practice, even though I've seen it be the most effective. Because yeah, we really are. I mean, it speaks to how attached to our suffering we are.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. We have an idea. Isn't that what the whole personality thing is? It's that we're attached to our coping mechanism. We've kind of created these mechanisms for pretending to be essence when we aren't, when instead of actually being it. And so it's, yeah. We've had this whole construction, we've invested a lot into it, and that's who we are. And the work comes along and says, is that true? and you're like, don't do that to me, man. This is sacred.
and then it has the audacity to ask the follow-up question. Can you absolutely know that it's true? That was the thing that really got, I mean, other than everything about the work, but I remember when I was discovering the work and I was like, the first question is it true? Which is already a slap in the face. And then the second one is, can you absolutely know that it's true?
Right.
And then when you hear like Byron, yeah, when you hear Byron Katie talking, it's just like, how can you ever, it's actually, I want to hear you respond to this. Like on the one hand, I hear you saying the answers to questions number one and two can be yes or no. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you've like been in the presence of Byron Katie, or if you've done the work in a sincere way, how can you ever answer question two with a yes?
Oh no, I can do that. Yeah, that's yeah, that's the freedom of exploration. Like it's like saying,
yeah,
what you're asking is like saying, if you're doing some kind of research, maybe I don't know what, some kind of science research, then how can you ever say that your hypothesis is not true? Or you know, like it's like saying that would be skewed research, that would be bias. And yes, we all are biased and it comes into play, but if it's possible, to whatever degree it's possible, the invitation is find out the truth, be unbiased. This is a question. And even though it's standing like a roadblock, treat it as an open-ended question that yes or no are equal. It's how you hold it. It's really how you hold it.
Right.
I feel free when I'm answering in front of anybody. I could answer in front of Byron Katie and I would say, yeah, if I'm seeing yes, then I'm saying yes. And I'm letting, for me, that's me letting my honest stuck self, maybe it's not even stuck, maybe it's just honest self, say my truth. For example, here's a perfect example of this.
Okay.
I want him to stop patronizing me. Okay. So let's say in that situation, I'm doing the work and I want him to stop patronizing me. And someone asks, is it true? I'm like, yes, it's true. Mm-hmm. Can you absolutely know it's true? You want him to stop patronizing you? Yeah, that's what I want. It's true. So good. I'm not going to fake that. I'm not going to fake that.
Right. Yeah. I'm reminded of the point that you made that was just like such a sledgehammer for me about the work today that's a helpful reorientation for me, is not answering the questions from your wise part, quote unquote, but from the part that filled out the worksheet, you know.
Yeah. That's
so
the part
from that point of view, from that point of view, I could see how you answer the second question with a yes.
Exactly. So yeah. If I'm answering from that place and I'm really believing it and the question, all it does is say, take a look again. But when I really do take a look again, but it's still that kind of complaining, stressed part of me, and it looks around and it looks again and it still doesn't see anything, then it's going to say, yes, it's true. Absolutely true. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's doing the work for me. That's honest. Because how else can we move the needle up in terms of evolution if the part that's holding the needle isn't doing the work? Otherwise, it's just a lot of hot air, a lot of fluff. Me like, yeah, I read this in a book and I remember this and this is similar to something that's intellectual, but it doesn't move the actual experience. And so it has to come from that answer for the questions have to come from inside where the stuck part happened. Mm-hmm. When I do it that way, things move, things change. And that's, that's it. Just thinking, like, after reading the book, and thinking about it just off and on the last week, I was seeing the Enneagram as almost a help in diagnostics in a way, help in noticing or knowing where to look possibly for what to work on. I say that with some hesitation because life will show you exactly what to work on. I trust that 100%. But there is something like, you know, like if one particular type has one particular weakness or tends to go in that direction when it's not clear, then those could be things that one would look out for, or that would be, they would naturally show up as stressful situations, but you could work backwards from something abstract like that to a specific situation if you wanted to work directly on a particular aspect of personality. Now, I say again with some hesitation because there is a principle in doing the work that, and probably in all spiritual work actually, that the more you try to get results, the more it pushes them away. And so the caution there is, if I'm using the Enneagram the Enneagram to diagnose myself, and therefore the assumption is I'm broken, I need to be fixed, then using the work to fix myself, it doesn't work that way, that you can't control that. It's out of our control. But if it's held right, it could be a very interesting thing to say, oh, you know what? This is my weak spot. Would be interesting to explore, and how would I do that? So that's another area that could also be, we could play with. And I don't have any absolute clear ideas on how that would work, but we could play with it.
Yeah, I love that insight about the, when you try to get results in spiritual work, it doesn't really work. You push those results away.
Yeah.
The way that I think about it is that no matter what, whenever you do the work, it is exposing where you're stuck, and where you're stuck could be thought of in Enneagram terms. Or if you do enough worksheets and you work through enough stuff, then you could you can almost retroactively determine your Enneagram type based on what tends to come up for you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like that Eckhart Tolle thing of you want to be a, your mind is, or your inner witness is like a cat watching mice come out of a hole in the wall. If you watch enough mice, and the mice are your thoughts and feelings. If you watch enough mice, you start noticing patterns, you know?
Yeah.
Exactly. And so, and the Enneagram is, you could say, the kind of actually quite rigid structure of your inner life that has certain kinds of things be more triggering for you than others, and certain reactive patterns tend to be more salient and consistent than others.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the cool thing about the work is that it can work with any kind of stuckness, whatever that happens to be. And, mm-hmm. and it's just moving, you would say in Enneagram terms, from I don't know exactly, lesser evolution to more evolution, like from,
right.
Nine to one, right? You're moving up, not the Enneagram numbers, but like the levels of evolution.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Right. So the work will meet you wherever you are, no matter what your particular type is, no matter what your particular, whatever particular state of evolution is, it's going to meet you right where you are and take you one little tiny step in that direction, possibly,
yeah.
depending on how you use it. Yeah.
So from the point of view of the centers, body, heart, mind. Yeah. So as I think I was saying this to you before when we first talked, that I was considering the work a kind of mental sensor oriented practice, because you take this thought, you fill out a worksheet, you ask questions, and then it opens up your mind to other possibilities. But doing the work, what I was struck by was like all these questions about, okay, put yourself back in that situation, like smell the smells, be in that moment. That's body talk. You know what I mean? That's like, and then also these questions of like, how do you respond? Who are you when, how do you react when you believe the thought? And then who would you be without the thought? In a certain sense, those are heart questions, but actually more, I don't know, less like gridded than that. I would say, like we talked about this on our last call, is the heart sensor in the Enneagram has to do with your sense of self, like your identity, how you, and your self-image, how you experience yourself. And for anything to be stressful, you know, it has to be like, for it to have gotten you, then it pertains to your identity in some way. It pertains to your self-image. How you're seeing. Yeah. Yeah, it has to.
It got you. So it's connected to you. It's personal, right?
That's
it
right.
Wouldn't be stressful if it wasn't personal. So that means it's connected to my sense of identity, which
yes.
in your terms would means that it's the heart, heart centered, I think. Is that the word you use? Heart centered?
Yeah, the heart center. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And there is this, there's a way that like our entire personality structure in Enneagram terms is locked into rigid place by the way that we are imbalanced in our centers. Our body's constricted and tense, our heart is collapsed around a particular self-image, our mental center is collapsed around a particular way of seeing and framing things, like our orientation. And the work starts with identifying a stressful moment, but then sort of in this moment, like you recall the memory, you put yourself in that position, you experience the bodily sensations of being there. And you, this is how, I'm trying to talk my way to this point. What I've heard Byron Katie say again and again is that the work is meditation. And what she means by that, I think, is you are asking a question and then like entering you're cultivating the inner conditions in which you can actually approach that question freshly. And yeah. And that requires a certain kind of relaxation in the body, like a certain kind of letting go of whatever rigidity that you were holding on to just kind of like see openly what was really happening. And it also requires entertaining the possibility that the way you were seeing yourself and experiencing your identity isn't actually the truth.
Yep.
And that includes seeing aspects of your shadow, like things that you wouldn't otherwise own about yourself. Like, oh, I'm actually the one being patronizing, or, am somebody who's being patronized. I'm a judgmental person. Yeah. And it also means potentially recognizing aspects of your golden shadow with like things that you wouldn't necessarily own about you that are really lovely. Like, I admire that person because they're so strong, whatever. And then the turnaround is like, oh, actually I'm strong, and seeing that. So anyway, I on some level, I'm trying to talk my way into understanding this, like this, how the centers are operating here. And there is a gestalt, like all three are sort of happening at once. They're all sort of relaxing at once, so that you can drop this question into an actually meditative inner state.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they're all involved in the process. You've said it clearly. Even how I react when I'm answering that question, I'm looking at my body sensations. That's another one of the sub questions. It's where do you feel it in your body? And I often feel constriction, and some thoughts constricted around the heart. Some thoughts it's constricted around the abdomen, you know, solar plexus. Some it's in the neck. Some it's, you know, a nervousness. It can be all kinds of things, or tension. So that's very, very visceral, very body oriented. The mind, of course, is involved whenever you're dealing with a thought. That's mental for sure. And when you're going through the process of finding these technical turnarounds, I mean, that's intellectual even, right? The intellect's involved, the mind's involved. And then finding examples, you're doing that in a scientific way. You could say it's intellectual a certain way, but what are you doing science on? You're doing science on your heart in a way. You're doing science on your identity, where your identity is being challenged, which is where you're feeling stressed. And so it is personal, and it is identified, your identity that you're looking at. The handle is the mind, but the starting part is real life, or which actually is the real starting part is emotion. That's how usually what tells me that I want to do the work is that I felt some emotion. So that's body. The body said, oh, you have a constriction here when this person waves his hand at me and says, so sorry. So that means there's something going on in me that isn't okay. What is it? And then I look for, because heart and mind or emotions and mind are always connected. So I look for a thought in the mind that's connected to that experience of constriction. And then I work the thought, but never have the thought and the emotion become separated. As I turn around the thought and play with it, it turns around the emotion, it turns around the experience on the inside. So I'm literally transforming my body experience at the same time that I'm playing with something in my mind. So it's three-dimensional. It's mental, but it's also physical. And like you say, it's also, what is it that caused this constriction in the first place? It's my identification with something that I'm calling really important. And that's me. And you just stepped on me, and I hate you for it. You know, so all of these are just three, they're all three involved in this process. Yeah, that's how I see it.
Yeah. Something else that struck me too about that was well said, by the way. And something that struck me is, as there was a moment when we were doing the work that we kind of started rummaging around for a word that would fit my inner experience more adequately. And that's a very similar thing that we do in another modality called focusing, which, are you aware of focusing? Jen Lin's focusing?
I'm not, no.
Okay. Jen Lin was a philosopher of consciousness and kind of became a person who interacted with therapy world because his philosophical question was, where does meaning exist before you put words to it? And it exists in the body. It's the felt sense. And and he developed this whole way of tuning into your felt sense of an experience and giving words to it. But as you are, as you try to describe it, sometimes your first guess or your first description doesn't actually feel congruent to the thing. So you take your words back, you check with it, and then maybe you revise your words. And when you find it, you know, like, oh, that's the word. That was it. You know, then like your body knows. It's like there's that resonance, you know.
That's like what we did when we were looking
that's
what we, for
that's
this
exactly what we did. Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And actually, interestingly enough, is that part of his research, he hung out with like Carl Rogers, I think, who was the guy who's, he was the humanistic psychologist guy who was famous for basically telling his clients to, his whole thing was unconditional positive regard, which is like actually just love your clients. And but they did some research, and the research found that a successful therapeutic engagement depended on a few things, one of which crucially had nothing to do with the therapist. So there were, number one was, I think number, okay, let me get this right. Number one was the empathic capacity of the therapist. Number two was the quality of the relationship between the therapist and the client. And the third thing was the client's own ability to sense their own felt sense freshly, as opposed to just spinning mentally on the same story and not actually letting something fresh arise.
Yeah.
And so that that aspect of the work, or that moment that we had maybe an hour ago or something of doing that, that's part of the meditation, is dropping in and letting like a new, like a fresh sensation arise, and then kind of giving a giving language to it, and then really naming it so that it feels heard.
Yes, that's it. No? That's what you were wanting from him, actually, in that situation, ironically. But that is
why
the work is so, why just identifying the stressful thought is so therapeutic in and of itself before you even question it, because you feel hurt.
Right.
That's that place in me that was been, I've been usually pushing it down, or it just bursts out, but it's sort of not really getting heard. And when I allow it, oh my gosh, it's like, wow, thank you. That's what that is. I feel patronized.
So that's why, I mean, this is why, and I hear you saying, and actually really appreciated your kind of correction that it's not, it's a sequence that works. It's not necessarily, you know, the dogmatic way to do it, but it's tried and true. But what I love about the sequence is that it starts with this, it starts with allowing the tantrum. And I just think as adults, depending on your Enneagram type, actually, many Enneagram types, not all, have a real issue with letting the tantrum out, you know. And I can imagine that for a lot of people approaching the work, just actually writing a worksheet and having all the pettiness feel heard and be expressed is a whole, that's a whole step. So I can see why that's therapeutic, and it has everything to do with just what we just were talking about, of like letting your actual inner felt sense, sensory experience be named and acknowledged and heard. And then once that's heard, a whole new thing opens up. So that's like that's central in focusing. And I just like made the connection today that it's like, oh, that's also, that's what we're doing also here in the work, if you're doing the work right.
Exactly. Little side benefit there, right? So it's part of the process of the work that you're also getting that.
So that's actually part of, it's actually in a certain way necessary to honor the tantrum in its like full tantrumic glory, you know, to just like put it on, the, you know, so that it feels heard as a preliminary step to create the inner conditions where then you can actually introduce a new or explore a new idea.
Because if you don't do that, it's, you're not talking about something real. You're dealing with, you're starting to go into philosophy, or you're starting to go into just theories, or you're talking about things in abstraction. But when you're allowing that tantrum to take place, Mm-hmm. The crying baby has entered the room, and now it's like its day has finally come, and it's been waiting for this, and so it's interested, it's paying attention, it's getting attention, but it's not. Here's the thing: I think some of it may be cultural. You know, there's taboo around mental illness, or taboos around being emoting in different ways. But some of it may be personality driven as well. As you just mentioned, a lot of the Enneagram types have issues with this. Regardless of what causes it, there's something that says don't do that. And so we've learned to not do that. Don't go into your stressful stories. And I think it might even be psychological, like in a good way, just a protection mechanism that we've somehow evolved into, to not open up a can of worms that we can't deal with, because that'll just make things worse. We've all done that. Like, you open up something, you know, grief is a great example of that. You start looking at old photographs, and you start crying again because this person's died, and then it just keeps, every time you do that, it's the same problem. So why go there? You're kind of like, oh, it's a can of worms. Right. I'm not going.
Yeah. There. Yeah.
So I think people tend to think that anything stressful, first of all, if it's stressful, I already don't know how to control it by definition. Otherwise I would. So it's something out of my control. It's something that is like a wildfire. It can just like go and take over my life. I can go get depressed. I can hurt people. I can, you know, negative emotion is, it has some side effects. So I think people are rightly, maybe all of us are rightly scared of it, and want to kind of push it down. And maybe that's a good thing. Like, okay, it's fine. We're pushed down, as long as at least I don't have a fire in my house. I've got it pushed down into a little coal inside of my liver or something. But at least I still have a marriage, or I have a job, or whatever. So I see the practical side of that. But what I love about the work is that it is a safe way to actually effectively deal with these stressful stories or stressful situations. When you hold it in the same way that we did the work here today, that part that needs to tantrum can tantrum. But where is it tantruming? It's not destroying another person, it's tantruming out onto paper, or it's speaking it out, and it's in a contained environment. And then these turnarounds and all the questions, they allow that part to do whatever healing it needs to do, to see things from another point of view, and to find out that, like, basically to deal with the thing that's causing the fire in the first place, and it kind of goes out. So that's the way I see the work. I just see it's understandable that we would suppress this stuff. I understand it. It's just now there's a way that you can really deal with it in a super effective and efficient way. And not that the work is unique in that way. Friends listening to each other can do similar things, and there are many ways, therapy and all of that. But it is such a cool, efficient, succinct, little, goes right to the heart of it method. And I love having that tool on the table. So, yeah.
You know, one of the things that I love about the work is that I think that on some level, we all carry around the delusion that we have an open mind. And especially when you live in a culture where, you know, on Instagram, you'll see memes about, like, it's, you know, have an open mind, or on dating apps, you know, it's like, my number one thing looking for in a partner is that they're open-minded, or I don't know, something like that. It's there's a standard of quote unquote open-mindedness that is paid lip service to in popular culture as a sign of, like, what it means to be a good person, quote unquote. Right. And the practice of having an open mind is very different from the image of having an open mind. And the work is probably the most effective tool I've ever seen to actually to work at it, to have an open mind and to be humbled kind of again and again at the ways that our mind closes around particular stories that justify our sense of self, that keep us in our suffering. And it really just is amazing. And one of the things, paragraph two, is that one of the things that I've been sitting with recently is just how like the Enneagram is so fascinating. It's so interesting, and people get so, including myself, just immersed in the mental model of it. And anytime I have a reaction to anything, I can just immediately, oh, that's clearly my three thing. I've got a six fix, my nine, like, oh, I'm this instinctual stacking. I can just easily categorize all of my reactions to this map that I carry around in my head. And that isn't inner work. You know, that isn't the same as like knowing and being able to categorize is not the same as actually working through the triggers and relaxing the patterns. And you could in Don Riso's levels, moving up the levels, you could say. And God, it amazes me so much how, like, to bring it back to that other point, that the more you are driving for results in your spiritual inner life, the less likely they are to, like, the more you're trying to ascend the levels of development of Don Riso's, like, levels of health, the less likely it's going to happen. So yeah, my head is swimming with all these ideas, but I guess to kind of paragraph four, wrap this little monologue up, is that I think that the Enneagram is still the most textured, robust, precise, interesting map of the inner world that I've ever come across. And it's just amazing. And yet it is just a map and a framework, and it is not itself a practice. And it's a tool to help you along a path. But the whole reason I'm doing this series, interviewing you and other people who help people with modalities of inner work, is to highlight what actually inner work looks like, what it looks like to work with yourself and to work with your triggers. So, period.
Yeah, no, it's a really good point. It's like, as you were speaking, I was thinking of medicine, you know, and diagnosis is not the same as cure. It's not the same as even treatment.
That's perfectly
understanding said. The problem is not the same as doing something or changing the problem, you know, fixing the problem, if you will. But understanding does give a kind of, well, it gives understanding, and there's something satisfying about understanding. There's something like it's intellectually satisfying and emotionally to a certain degree as well. There's a, oh, okay, so I'm not crazy. It's just, that's the way I'm built. Okay, great. Thank you, Enneagram. I get it now. I'm like this, and it's to be predicted that I would be like this. And we all have our own little ways of being in the world. And so it's cool to understand things in relation to a bigger theory or a bigger perspective that I think the Enneagram gives. And I think insights can come out of that that will naturally lead to evolution. I don't doubt that for a second. And I think there's some letting go that happens as well in that. But I think you're absolutely right. There's just something really valuable about how do I move through my steps of evolution? Is there a practical way? And that's where practices of all kinds come in. And I've, there are many, but I think that a practice, in addition to the understanding, that's like the best of both worlds. Now I'm evolving through an actual practice, and I'm understanding as well. So I can enjoy the understanding and be seeing some actual changes in my relationships or in my inner experience of peace or happiness. So I agree. Sometimes people, I've often heard people say, talk about the work of Byron Katie as the how, and it's an interesting way of thinking of it. Like there's the what of spiritual development, you know, freedom, what it looks like. It's described so well in terms of essence in the Enneagram. There's so many ways to talk about it in many traditions. And there are many ways in terms of the how, but Byron Katie's is such a simple and easily accessible how. Like, take this step, follow this step, go through these little points, and there's often some evolution happening in just 20, 30 minutes. So yeah, it's a good mate. It's a good symbiotic relationship, I think, between understanding and like an overall grid of understanding of the mind and spirit, and then something very practical and mundane in a way, but delivering something that is beyond mundane. I think of the work as spirituality in the mundane, spirituality in mm-hmm. yeah. a stressful, tiny, petty little moment. If I can find spirituality there, that's pretty cool. Otherwise, I've always thought of spirituality as something out of the world. I go meditate somewhere and just be alone. But the work brings it into the world. It's integrating.
Yeah. Well said. Yeah. Have you heard of spiral dynamics or frameworks adjacent to it, like Cezanne Kreuter's?
I don't think so. No.
Okay. So I've studied a pretty good amount of theories of adult ego development. And cool. So theories like spiral dynamics. There's a woman named Cezanne Kreuter who has a whole theory called constructive ego development theory. And it is about stages of consciousness, you could say. And there are actually a lot of different theories that map these, and they all sort of stand adjacent to each other. They're all mapping the same vertical territory where what's happening at each stage. Robert Keegan would be another thinker in this field. They're all mapping how our consciousness can expand to include more sources of truth, to be more open-minded, you could say. Mm-hmm. And different stages are anchored at different values. That's what spiral dynamics is about. And then Cezanne Kreuter's theory talks about the evolution of how we make meaning in the world. And there's a very interesting question in the general field of adult developmental psychology, which what is it that spurs development? What are the conditions in which development happens? Mm-hmm. And I took a 9-month program learning about Cezanne Kreuter's theory with her and another amazing woman named Bina Sharma. And Bina in particular highlighted the work of Byron Katie as, like, if she were to recommend a single practice to facilitate development, it would be the work. Because of the way that it meets you where you are, no matter where you are. Yep. It's super accessible. I mean, a child could do it. Yep. And it is always inviting a fuller picture of reality that is just slightly more expanded from the contracted way that we tend to see the world at first blush. And one way to characterize what development really is seeing the world more expansively, more expansively, more expansively. Yeah. So, and literally, I mean, taking a thought and then, like, he's patronizing me and starting in the narrow view that that's true, and here's all the evidence that I could marshal to substantiate that claim. And then turning it around and just asking the question, well, what if the opposite were true? And could I find other evidence? That has a real impact developmentally. Yeah. And so I just want to say that because I think I agree now, having gone through that 9-month program and having dabbled in a bunch of different modalities of inner work. If I were to suggest one thing for a person, it would be the work. Yeah, that's just how much like respect I have for it.
So, cool. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, it's amazing. I don't know how it just Byron Katie stumbled across it. She says it found her, you know. Doesn't she matter. Went, right? But somehow we've got these four questions and turnarounds and this whole judge your neighbor worksheet and the whole thing, and it's just it's effective. It's effective. I've been doing it for, I don't know, 16 years, something like that. A long time, consistently, almost every day. And that's the feeling, is that just every time I do it, just a little more expansion, a little more expansion, a little more expansion. And it's just this gradual process over time of expanding and expanding and expanding, that there's just less and less problems. There's less and less things that catch me. I describe it as being more unflappable, and yet more humble, more able to own that I'm totally crazy in this particular regard. And that's freeing as well. So it's a beautiful companion in life to just have a little practice of the work, take like 20, 30 minutes a day and just do a little bit of questioning. What's the latest stressful situation? What was I thinking in that moment? And then go through the process. So yeah, it's effective. I also find it integrating. It integrates outer and inner.
That's good.
I find that, and for me, that's important. Like I'm sort of leaning towards being a 9 in Enneagram in my limited understanding so far. And so for me, my tendency is to close my eyes and tune out the world and do a meditation that leaves me feeling peaceful, but I still don't know how to interact with my neighbor. And the work, and I love that kind of meditation. I do that, but the work integrates, it brings the spirituality of my inner sanctum out into the world of everyday life, and that's a breath of fresh air. Like that's like, oh, that's practical. Now I'm getting some of the benefit of spiritual awakening in my everyday life. It can actually turn around things, relationships, health, money, all kinds of crazy things that I would have said all my life, oh, I don't really care about those things. So yeah, the work, it brings together the outer and the inner. And for that, I am really grateful. It's a powerful tool in that way.
Yeah. So yeah, I want to end, or I'll just say one other thing about the the way we approach inner work is always in the style of our type. And the way that, like, as I was doing my very best to just kind of be vigilant about my type structure, which is basically, so like type 3 is this type that it's a heart type, meaning it's a type in the kind of the image or identity center. And it's all the three heart types, 2, 3, and 4, have a particular relationship with needing to prop up and support a self-image and a particular kind of self-image that they see as valuable and that they would like to be seen. And these ways of performing to an internalized standard of how to do the work is particularly 3-ish, I would say. And a lot of people relate to type 3, and there's a whole other thing that we don't have to get into around trifix, so that everyone, there are a lot of people that have a lot of 3 in them, even if you're not a core type 3. Like, for example, even though you might be a core 9, 9 is a body type, and you still have a type in your heart center and mental center. So your heart type could be type 3.
Got it.
Anyway, my point is that this, you know, you could imagine how each Enneagram type approaches doing the turnarounds in the style of their type. Like I could imagine a 6, which is a mental type, that is very good at driving themselves crazy by considering every single possibility, is you could imagine how that colors the way that they approach doing the work. Am I doing it right? Have I considered the right turnaround? Is this how you do it? And, you know, I could sort of go around the whole Enneagram, which I won't, but that's the way that you approach doing the work. You sort of have to, there's like a, maybe another layer of, as you're doing it, or maybe if you're a facilitator, you're kind of like watching for and catching other people as they're falling into the delusion of their type in a way that's contaminating the process of doing the work as opposed to really doing it.
Yep. You know, one of the things that Byron Katie trained us as facilitators in was when you're facilitating somebody, you're kind of balancing two things. You're, first of all, giving them all the space they need to go deeply inward, and you're not interrupting their meditation. You're not taking over. You're not trying to lead them or trying to give them the answers or anything like that. You're waiting for it to come from within them, and you're giving them space for that. And that's on one side. And then on the other side, balancing that is that if the person is getting distracted, in this case, you're talking about distracted by their own personality or whatever quirks they have, or is no longer answering the question, is kind of getting out of the track of actually going inward and answering the question that was posed, then the job of the facilitator is to just gently remind them of what we're doing. Like, just ask the question again, or just kind of like, oh yeah, what were we doing again? Right. Or, oh, it's not necessary to look at every one of the thousand angles on this particular one. I think you've covered it, you know, whatever, gently holding the space for them to have the meditation be front and center rather than the personality be front and center, or whatever escape mechanisms they may want to try to do. Not that you're holding them there captive, because but if someone sincerely wants to do the work, the mind will sometimes run away from that question. And without making it wrong, facilitator can just bring them back and say, okay, let's try it again and see if there's anything more there. So as you're mentioning that, it just reminded me of that. And I would say that our personalities, of course, are going to get in the way of us answering the questions. The personality itself, if it really is a coping mechanism, if it really is just a kind of a cover-up fake version of who we really are, then its life is at stake by doing this work. It's a little bit threatened, and it's probably going to, first of all, just follow its natural patterns, but second of all, may even resist a little bit, in which case that's normal, no problem. It's just, okay, let's try again. The work's a process. Let's come back to that question. Let's try again, but always with gentleness. I think that's the key for making the work a positive experience. You could use the work as a weapon, but I don't think that's not the intention here. It's just an invitation to come and see what's beyond what you already know and see, and your own tendencies. But I also think, just to contradict myself in the final point here, is that even the personality showing up in different ways is, it can be part of the process. It can be part of the way home as well. And so allowing that to have its day, and I don't know. Those are some thoughts.
I'm smiling because it's characteristic of people who have done the work for a long time that they are able to see the value and truth of so many sides of a thing. And so, like, which is a muscle that you build doing the work, but it's like, if the personality shows up, of course, that's why not, you know?
Yeah. You know? That's true. It's funny. And that is one of the side benefits, or maybe even the benefit of the work eventually. It's like, it's a practice. So it's this formal practice. You sit down, you either do it with somebody, or you do it in writing. But in the end, it builds a muscle that you take out into the world. You know, you may go to the gym for an hour here and there, but those muscles come out with you wherever you go, and they can be used to lift anything at any time. And it's the same with these kind of internal mental or spiritual or emotional muscles, that you start being able to see turnarounds or see other points of view spontaneously without even having to do the work. It's a nice benefit from doing the work.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I am amazed at you just read this book, The Wisdom of the Enneagram, which is your first really encounter with the Enneagram in a deep way. And your facility with the concepts is already just quite amazing. And I don't know what to attribute that to. Maybe it's just the path that you've been on, and you're like the way that you're talking about personality and essence and stuff. It's indicative of a person who's been on the path for a while. So, and also just your facility with analogy and metaphor is amazing. I find you extremely articulate and just refreshing with your insightfulness. So thank you for all that.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a pleasure. And I think the Enneagram just resonated with me. So, and that whole book, The Wisdom of the Enneagram, just really was like, wow, I love that they're saying it. I love the freshness. For me, it's fresh because I haven't heard those particular angles or those particular ways of talking about the same truths that I've read from other places. In fact, it was the same thing when I discovered the work of Byron Katie. I was not new to spiritual practice, but it was fresh words. It's like, oh, wow, okay, she's speaking in American. And I get that, right? I like that. And I think this one is speaking in a very analytical way. And I have that quality also. And it resonates, and it's very precise. And I love that. It's just refreshing and insightful, and I can see myself studying the Enneagram and getting, learning more about it and getting interested in it. I just see it as a beautiful new adjunct in my life. So from my side, I just want to thank you for inviting me and sort of welcoming me into this unexpected turn for me. And I've appreciated your sincerity and your depth and your willingness to back up and say, wait, oh, here's what I'm doing, self-revealing, and just your general curiosity and interest. So it's been a pleasure, and I really have enjoyed every moment of speaking with you.
Man, I feel the same. Thanks for saying all that. It means a lot. And yeah, this has been great. Thank you for spending so much time with me too. This has been almost 3 hours. This is the longest this is the longest interview I've ever done. It felt right. Yeah.
Yeah, me too. I didn't want to stop. It's been fun. It's been enlightening. It's been uplifting. And I felt free to explore in so many different directions. And it just feels like mutual learning here and exchange. And yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Cool. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me for my conversation with Todd Smith about the work of Byron Katie. If you like Todd and you want to learn more about him, then you can check him out at his own website, theworkasmeditation.com. You can also check out his podcast called Wiggle Room, where he does just what he did here with me. He leads people through the work. And you can also sign up to do an individual session with him through his website if you'd like for him to facilitate you in the work. I highly recommend it. He's a beautiful facilitator, and the work obviously comes with my highest recommendations. If you are curious about Byron Katie herself, then I recommend going to thework.com. The work, you can also download free PDFs of the official Judge Your Neighbor worksheet there. And if you're really interested, then what I recommend doing is just Googling her and checking out one of her YouTube videos so you can actually see who she is and experience her energy. I realize it's sort of a provocative statement to say that she's an enlightened being, but that is actually my genuine experience. And I've spent time with her in the same room and have been facilitated in the work by her. And it is quite remarkable and actually was a life-changing moment for me. Maybe I'll share a bit about that another time. If you enjoyed this podcast and you've learned from either this episode or episodes in the past, then I would super appreciate if you consider subscribing to this YouTube channel, or if you're listening to this on a podcast, then please leave a review. that is a zero cost and low effort way for you to support me and the Enneagram School. I super appreciate that. I also recommend checking us out at theenneagramschool.com. You can sign up for our email list. I just put up a freebie download, like 9 types in 1 page, you know, free Enneagram guide. So you can go check that out. Also, the Enneagram School email list is where I'll be sending out updates about, for example, upcoming programs. I'm doing a new thing where I am taking volunteers to be coached in front of a live Zoom audience. And the first one has already happened, and I'm still taking volunteers. This is going to be a series of them. And I think that what I like about this idea is that it gives a chance for people to actually experience what a person is like in real time and what it's like to watch a person be coached. Sessions are structured where it's part coaching and then part debrief. And so if you show up as an audience member, then you'll get to ask me questions as the coach and also the coachee questions in the debrief section. So definitely check that out. The next ones are going to be announced both in email and also on the Enneagram School website. And also another announcement, John Lekovich and I are almost finished and are about to release our first ever Introduction to the Enneagram course official through the Enneagram School. So stay tuned for that. Finally, if you think that you might be a good candidate for me to interview you on this podcast, then please reach out. I am in need of hexad types. So that's the types 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, and 8. If you are one of those types, that'd be great. Preference goes to people that have been officially typed by the Enneagrammer team. And if you would like to get officially typed by them, then you can check them out at Enneagrammer.com. That's Enneagram and then with an extra M-E-R.com. They have typing services and they are the best in the world at it. So check them out. And finally, if you know someone who is a really good practitioner of a modality of inner work that I have not featured yet on the show, then please submit that to me as well. I'm curious to learn more about what else is out there, and there's a lot that I don't know. So look forward to hearing from you. And again, thank you so much for joining from this conversation, and I will see you next time.